asked the judge for an early recess, and Dickey said, oh, he's still got some time. He says, put the prosecuting witness on and go as far as we can, and we'll recess at 12 o'clock. So I put her on the witness stand, and she said, she testified that she was sitting in her living room in Fairmount, Indiana, and there was a long walk from the sidewalk back to her house. She was sitting there sewing and looking out of the front room window, and this man was walking by the house and spied her, and he come up, opened the front door and come in and says, honey, I can go for you, and took me in and threw me on the bed, and of course, as an element of proof, you actually have to prove, you know, that he had entered, and I was trying to get this out, and she said, and the last thing I remember, he says, was when his hair fell down my face, and here's this guy sitting over there, bald head, it was a billiard ball. And I got up and said to the judge, I said, I would like to move for dismissal of this case. And Judge Dickey was laughing on the inside, and he said, no, he says, this is good experience for you. he said, we'll recess now, and you come back this afternoon. But there was a note on Mr. Hardin's desk, and he had to go back in the afternoon. but we had a lot of interesting cases. There was a fellow in this town by the name of, in Gas City, by the name of Roy Bogle, that later shot his wife, or his divorced wife. And he had received a substantial award from the United States government for services he had done in World War I, and had some money and was getting a fairly good sized pension. And he got in an argument with some bootlegger because he wouldn't sell him booze over around Gas City, and I don't remember whether he took after him with a knife or what, but anyway, he was charged with assault and battery with intent, and Harley assigned that case to me to try. Benedict from Muncie, who was quite a defender, represented Mr. Bobo, and I did my best to send that guy to the penitentiary. And I argued that, you know, that about this fellow, that he was dangerous to be out, that he could have easily killed this man, and much larger than the fellow that he went after. But Benedict, in cross-examining the jury, kept talking, or in the voir dire, rather, not cross-examining, but the jury kept talking about this guy being a bootlegger, and he was going to be tried the next day for bootlegging, and as Benedict was wont to do, he, in his closing argument, waved the American flag and carried from the Civil War through World War I, and the jury ended up giving them a small fine for assault and battery, but spent all their time up there deciding what they were going to do to that bootlegger the next day. And of course, the thing they didn't know is that the fellow that was defending the bootlegger come out and got them all excused. And they didn't get a chance to convict them like they thought they were going to do. But on the following day. No, it wasn't that day. A couple of days later, I was sitting at the typewriter there in the office typing up a something. And in walks Bobo into the office. And I'd said enough about him that I figured he'd come in to clean me. And he got about halfway across the room and he pulled a revolver out of his pocket. And I thought, geez, it's going to be worse than I thought for, you know. And he come in and he slammed it down on the typewriter desk and he says, I want you to get me a permit to carry this gun. And I said, well, I don't have anything to do with that. You have to either get it from the chief of police or from the sheriff's office. And I'm sure that they're not going to issue it to you. And tried to explain to them to get them off of the hook, you know, because I knew that they wouldn't. And he said, well, I've got some people after me. And I said, well, you may think you have, but I said, I doubt very much if you have. And finally got him out of the office, but I, for about 30 seconds, I thought I was a goner, you know. But this business, back to these three black boys that were arrested. The night that they took them out of the jail, my wife and I were visiting some of her friends who lived at about 18th and Adams Street. And I heard the fire trucks and the sirens, rather. I don't know if it was fire trucks or police. I heard the sirens and all the way out to 18th and Adams Street. And I said, well, I told these people, my guess is that the things happening, what the prosecutor had told the sheriff, could happen. And that they're probably going to take, if they can get in, they're going to get to the old lynching. And somebody in the crowd suggested that we come downtown, and I said, no, I'm going to get on the streetcar and go back to Gas City because I don't want to be around that. I'm a great lover, but not a very good fighter. And of course, the next morning, it was in the paper, and
that's the first time you actually knew what happened.
The first time that I knew exactly what had happened. And I came into the office, and Mr. Harden's door was closed, and I opened it up and walked in, and I said, boy, they sure saved us a hell of a lot of work last night, didn't they? And here was reporter from the Chicago Tribune, the Indianapolis Star, and everybody else, and it looked like a funeral in there, you know, and of course, instantly I knew I'd been said the wrong thing, and I thought, gee, I don't want to even pick up the paper tomorrow, but thank God they were very charitable and said nothing about it. We later on tried I know only know about one, but it seemed to me like we tried might have tried more. I was thinking that there was a second one that was tried. But the Attorney General's office came down and were appointed, I think, maybe special prosecutors or something, and they handled the grand jury work.
Do you remember what the circumstances were for the authority? Because I know you participated in it. it appears what happened was, as a meeting when it was over, there was some feeling either by the prosecutor or by somebody that something had to be done rather immediately. And it appears from the record that there may have been some conversation with the circuit judge about something. And he, for some reason, suggested that this was all the orderly business and would be handled in the September term of the grand jury. But somewhere in the process, there was founded a special board of inquiry, and that would have been within the next few days following this thing. That would have been August the 13th when it was convened. And it was presided over by a man by the name of Sturgis Watson, who was a justice of the peace. And there were no, everything was kept secret, the witnesses, everything else. And I have in my possession a transcript of that proceeding, which I found in the state archives. And I know you sat in on some of those, because Harley did most of the questioning, but you would occasionally ask a question about something, and I neglected to bring that thing with me.
I don't even remember that.
You don't remember that. I'll get that, a copy of that, so you can see it sometime, because it was quite a revelation to me, because these cases weren't appealed, and I thought the only way to have it is find Clara Link and find if she had a transcript of these trials. I understand about 2 or 3 years ago they took all those old transcript books out the dump and threw them away, so the only thing I have is this transcript that gives me any idea. And it's not particularly revealing in any way. But this happened from August the 13th to August the 15th. And out of that was just statements that there were a number of people who were going to be indicted. And then the grand jury convened on September the 2nd. And there was a long, exhaustive grand jury investigation, but nothing was released. They kept delaying the final report, and they'd indict some other people who committed crimes, but nothing ever kept coming out about this. And finally, on October the 8th, the grand jury adjourned with no indictments at all, praised Sheriff Campbell for his actions, and indicted Cameron and Sullivan, the two survivors. Cameron specifically was about 15 or 16 years old. And then at that juncture, with no indictments filed, and Ogden on October the 15th filed the impeachment proceedings against Camel and indicted 8 or 9 people. 8 people. Subsequent to that, there were 2 trials held. The first one was by a man by the name of Robert Beshire, B-E-S-H-I-R-E, who was a pool hall owner or something like that. The second one was for a taxi cab driver by the name of Charles Lennon.
I participated in that trial with the Deputy Attorney General on Lennon.
Okay. Those Deputy Attorney Generals were named Earl Stroop.
Stroop and Wall.
Earl Wall. Both, I think, from Frankfort.
Yeah.
And they were here off and on. Well, let's just for the sake of picking up here. Is there anything you remember about the evidence in that trial with Lennon that would shed light on the shooting circumstances or the lynching itself?
I don't even recall being present at that trial. I know this. Think I know this, that Mr. Hardin was not wanting anybody indicted because he was sure from the sense of things that he had learned around over the county that it would be impossible to convict anybody for that crime.
Would he might have thinking it also might be unpopular? From a political standpoint?
No, I don't think that he thought it was unpopular. I think it was purely from the standpoint that he had a number of, quite a few friends around over the county that he relied on their judgment. And that he contacted them and talked to them, and I know that he made the statement to me. He said that they ought to be indicted and something ought to happen to them, but he says you never, from what I'm, the information I'm gathering, he says you couldn't get a jury in Grant County that would convict them.
Was there any thought given to change of venue anyway?
No. And I'm not sure at that time that
you could take a change?
Whether they could take the change or it was an unpopular thing to do. And
well, I don't know either. I think you could, because I think they venue.
I know defense could venue, but I don't recall of anything in this area that had ever been venued by the state.
Would you have any reason
to? And I would have thought, as vigorous as Stroop and Wall were in trying to get this prosecuted, if they could have venued it, they would have venued it. Now, this is just an opinion, because this taxi cab driver was represented by this same Zone Graves that I was telling you about before. And he pulled a real sharp one on Wall in that case, or in Stroop. Wall was going to do the argument, and Wall had told me that he had spent most of the night before he was going to present the argument the next day to the jury working on his argument. And he said, I'll send that fellow to jail with my final argument. The evidence really was a little weak, as I recall. I thought maybe they'd be able to get a better case, but against this man. Wall made the mistake that many lawyers make, that in his first argument to the jury, he didn't say much. And was saving all of his thunder after the defense attorney had maybe it wasn't Zone that was that defendant. It might have been Dempsey.
I think it was Dempsey.
It was Dempsey that was defending. But Zone had been sitting in the courtroom. This is where he came in. He'd been sitting in the courtroom listening to this argument. And they had a recess. And I was out in the hallway, and Zone grabbed Dempsey and says, "If you're real smart, you waive closing argument." Dempsey come in and waive closing argument. You never saw a guy so deflated in your life as Merle Wall was, you know, because he didn't get any punches. And I don't remember how long the jury was out. It was out a little while. They came back in with a not guilty verdict.
What kind of guy did you know was Stroop and Wall? Were you around them much when they were here?
Only, yeah, I was around them quite a bit when they were here.
What kind of guys were they?
Well, I think they were good lawyers. Or I formed an opinion that they were good lawyers. Stroop was would probably be a better lawyer in a civil case than he would in a criminal case, with the exception that he knew the rules of evidence and he knew what he was doing, and he did bring out everything that he could possibly bring out in a trial. And I think it was a good combination, because I think Wall was a forceful speaker, and he was sharp, as I recall, and as many smaller men are, fiery, you know, and I think the job that he had assigned to him to present his final argument was properly given to him.
Do you know where they stayed here and when they stayed?
I think they stayed at Spencer House. Spencer. Runs in my mind that that's where they stayed. I thought they were very thorough in everything that they did. But I made the same mistake that even after seeing it done by Wall, sometimes in a jury trial of not getting enough stuff in on the preliminary and saving it for the final.
Let me go back just a minute. Do you have any recollections? Did the traction car come in and go around the square? Do you have any recollections the morning after the lynching? I assume you rode the traction car in, of seeing anything or your observations that morning, people or no people, or damage or debris?
No, I don't have any real recollections. I know that sometime during the day there were an unusual amount of spectators around, and the people started whittling on the tree.
Did you ever hear anything about a story of Dieter's bloody shirt being put in the window of the city hall from the police station side?
No, I never heard that story.
Did you?
This mob was an unusual mob, I would think, in that one of the boys, they had him halfway, I was told, to the courthouse, and he convinced them that he had come in on a train and was down there at the jail for trespassing on railroad property, and they carried him back to the jail and handed him over to the sheriff and put him back. And from the things that I've read about mobs,
unusual.
This was very unusual.
Did you at any time ever talk to anyone who you knew that was a mob member or participated or saw anyone?
No, I never did talk. I never knew anybody that participated. Never talked to anybody else that seemed to know anybody that participated. I just wondered how a thing like that could develop and not more people being recognized.
Do you recollect hearing that Mr. Hardin made a speech down on the steps of the jail that night, trying to discourage the crowd?
Very dimly. I think that he probably did. Knowing him, that he would have done something like that. And since you mentioned it, it kind of rings a bell, but I'm not real sure about that.
Let me ask you about Jake Campbell. What kind of guy was Jake Campbell?
Well, he was a kind of a blustery, well-met, I don't know what word to use it. going to say crude, but he wasn't crude exactly, but he was he'd been a former policeman. I think he'd been a captain of the force.
The type of guy would swear once in a while, or
yeah, he'd swear a little.
Is he kind of paunchy at that time?
Very paunchy.
He dressed in uniform or out of uniform?
Out of uniform. Matter of fact, the sheriff's department in uniform around here has been the last 25 years. He was a. I was trying to think about the political thing around here at that time, and there was a man named Jones that for years was the power in the Republican Party. And Harley was in the Jones faction. And I think Camel tried to get rid of Jones.
Yeah, he was the county chairman. Jake was.
Yeah. And from that standpoint, they kind of took up sides, you know, a little bit.